On the show today, the latest on the rebellion in Russia.
And the fact that Prigozhin escaped punishment, at least for now, greatly undermines Putin's position, at least in the eyes of the military.
Plus, Islamic State militants face trial in Kurdish-held Syria.
The decision to put the IS members on trial in Syria was made because their countries of origin won't take them back and local authorities cannot detain them permanently.
And later, a visit to the Dadaab refugee camps and a movement to ban all guns in the United States. Today is Monday, June 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. Millions of pilgrims are expected in Saudi Arabia on Monday as the Hajj begins. We'll have that story in a few minutes. First, though, the rebellion of the Wagner Group mercenary fighters in Russia against the Kremlin appears to have stopped for now. We get the latest from Reuters' Angela Johnston.
Mutinous Russian mercenaries who had been surging to Moscow agreed to turn back on Saturday to avoid bloodshed. That's according to the leader of the Wagner private army, Yevgeny Prigozhin.
ЧВК Wagner.
In an audio message, the former ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin said his forces got about 125 miles from the capital. Now the moment has come when blood could be spilled, he said, adding, we are turning our columns around. Reuters could not independently verify how far fighters got. The de-escalation of the major challenge to Putin's grip on power was brokered by Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, his office said. Under the deal, Prigozhin will move to Belarus, the Kremlin said, with safety guarantees for the leader and his men. It all marked a dramatic U-turn from just hours before, with Russian armored vehicles rolling past the Kremlin, checkpoints outside Moscow and warnings to residents to avoid going out. And in the previously rebel-captured city of Rostov-on-Don, troops began pulling out by Saturday night. The lightning insurrection appeared to unfold without much pushback from Russia's regular armed forces. Prigozhin had said his so-called March for Justice was intended to remove corrupt and incompetent Russian commanders he blames for botching the war in Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the Wagner revolt exposed, quote, complete chaos in Russia. It came just as Kyiv is launching its strongest counteroffensive since the war began last year. Western capitals said they were watching developments closely, with U.S. President Joe Biden speaking with the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany.
That was Angela Johnston of Reuters. So we know that the Wagner Group head Yevgeny Prigozhin led a rebellion through southern Russia and was headed towards Moscow when a deal was brokered by the Belarusian president to allow him safe passage to Belarus to avoid a bloody fight. For more, I'm joined by Danila Galperovich of VOA's Russian service.
No one knows for sure where Prigozhin is now. It's quite possible that somehow he reached Belarus, but there is no evidence for this. Yet at the same time, we remember that Alexander Lukashenko, who quite unexpectedly became a moderator or intermediary between Kremlin and Prigozhin, he has longstanding contradictions with Wagner Group, because back in 2020, by order of Lukashenko, mercenaries from Wagner Group were arrested in some hotel in Belarus, whom the Belarusian leader at that time suspected of organizing the coup against him. So since then, of course, everything could have changed, because now Lukashenko is very dependent on Vladimir Putin. But one way or another, there is still no clear confirmation that Prigozhin and his mercenaries got to Belarus.
Is there any speculation that Lukashenko may be double-crossing Prigozhin?
There is no confirmation for this as well. And all we know about this negotiation, so-called, we know from Kremlin as official source, Lukashenko as official source. We didn't hear any confirmation about his conversation with Lukashenko from Prigozhin himself. But we don't know yet, was it exactly as Kremlin and Minsk explained it to us?
Well, focusing on the rebellion, the so-called rebellion itself, did it have popular support?
We know for sure that Prigozhin's mercenaries were greeted as heroes in Rostov-on-Don, which they quickly took control on Saturday, this big city in the south of Russia. And I just remind our listeners that in Rostov-on-Don is the headquarters of the southern group of Russian armed forces. So it's staff quarter of real aggression of Russian army against Ukraine. So people in the center of this city escorted Prigozhin's mercenaries with applause and shouts, "Your heroes, come back again." It is quite obvious that the sympathy of the city in which the coordination of Russian aggression against Ukraine is actually taking place is clearly not on the side of the regular Russian army, but belongs to Wagner Group.
So this is clearly the strongest threat that Vladimir Putin has faced. Is his image as a strongman, as a leader, tarnished?
Yes, it is a very serious blow to Putin's image, because it's quite obvious that at first he reacted extremely slow to the development of events that could actually seriously frighten not only the Moscow's population, but also all those who work in Moscow in like different power structures. And then, of course, when he called Prigozhin traitor on TV, then he forgave Prigozhin very quickly, deciding not to punish him in any way. So it's just need to be reminded that according to some preliminary data, as a result of Prigozhin's rebellion, Russian army lost several helicopters and about 10 people were killed, which is actually just crime in any country. So in Russian prosecutor's office accused Prigozhin of very serious crimes. And the fact that Prigozhin escaped punishment, at least for now, greatly undermines Putin's position, at least in the eyes of the military.
So we also know that media in Russia is controlled by the state. What do the Russian people know about what happened?
This is a very good question, because, of course, Russian official TV, and I watched it for about 36 hours, never mentioned real events. Like, they never showed Prigozhin speaking with generals in Rostov-on-Don. They never gave him the microphone, so to say. But people using many social media, like Telegram, for example, which is not blocked in Russia, and of course everyone who is, watching this in Telegram, they know what's going on. So I believe that people knew something. But of course, in the areas where TV is the main source of information, people were really confused, because out of the blue, they hear about some traitor Prigozhin personally from Putin, and they never knew who Prigozhin is. So, somehow reminds me the Soviet times, when people who wants to have information listened to Western so-called enemy voices like Radio Liberty, which is from America, and at the same time, Soviet TV didn't show truth anyway. So I think to some extent, people now know who Prigozhin is, and they can Google it.
Danila Galperovich is a journalist with VOA's Russian service. Danila, thanks so much for your time this evening.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
The annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca begins on Monday, and Saudi Arabian officials are expecting the number of pilgrims to reach pre-pandemic levels, with millions of Muslims expected to visit the Kaaba, the shrine at the center of Islam's holiest site. AP correspondent Mimi Montgomery has the story.
Muslim pilgrims are streaming into the holy city of Mecca ahead of Hajj, one of the world's largest religious gatherings, and now returning to full capacity after years of COVID restrictions. The event, which sees Muslims circle the Kaaba stone, will attract millions of domestic and foreign pilgrims, among them Mahbub Murshed from Bangladesh.
This year, crowd is too much, okay, because last year and the year before this last year, it was restricted.
Those attending are not just concerned about the monumental scale of the event. Indonesian pilgrim Muhammad Fadli says another challenge is the Saudi heat.
A huge people here, crowd around 3 million, that I think. So it's very challenging with the weather, hot weather.
I'm Mimi Montgomery.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Greece's conservative New Democracy Party won a landslide victory in the country's second election in 5 weeks on Sunday, gaining enough parliamentary seats to form a government for a second four-year term. On Sunday, Pakistan's parliament approved the government's budget, which was revised to meet International Monetary Fund conditions in a last-ditch effort to secure the release of more bailout funds. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised the thwarting of what he said was an Iranian attack against Israeli targets in Cyprus. And one person was killed and several others injured when a roller coaster derailed at an amusement park in Stockholm on Sunday. Seven people, including children, were hospitalized. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The underwater Hunga Tonga Hunga Haapai volcano, located near the main island of the South Pacific archipelago Tonga, exploded with a violent eruption in January 2022. Scientists say the explosive force of the eruption was comparable to the 1991 Mount Pinatubo and 1883 Krakatoa eruptions. A new study published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters provides evidence that this major outburst wreaked even more havoc than thought. According to a press release from the U.S. Geological Survey, the volcanic explosion created what they called a supercharged thunderstorm that had the most powerful lightning ever recorded. The study shows that throughout the eruption, there were 192,000 flashes of lightning. The scientists found that lightning flashes peaked at more than 2,600 flashes every minute. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. We'll find out about a movement that's seeking to ban guns in the United States in a little bit. Now, the U.S.-backed Kurdish authorities in northeast Syria are adamant about holding trials for hundreds of foreign Islamic State group militants in their custody. VOA's Zana Omer has the story, narrated for us by Sirwan Kejo.
Foreign members of the Islamic State militant group who have been detained for several years will soon begin to face trial on charges of crimes against humanity and war crimes, Kurdish authorities in northeast Syria say. Over 10,000 fighters were taken prisoners when the Islamic State group was defeated in 2019 by Kurdish troops with U.S. and international support. According to local officials, the decision to put the IS members on trial in Syria was made because their countries of origin won't take them back and local authorities cannot detain them permanently.
According to international human rights law, these individuals have the right to be tried. They can no longer remain in prison without trial. A court decision must come out to determine their crimes and punishments.
The local Kurdish-led administration is not recognized by any party inside or outside Syria, making it difficult to garner international support for the proceedings. Despite such challenges, local authorities say they are committed to holding fair trials for IS suspects. International rights groups may play a part in this, experts say.
The international community should offer help in these trials, especially rights groups. In fact, the United Nations should lead such assistance efforts for these trials.
Authorities say that because IS members are accused of committing crimes against the Syrian people, it only makes sense to try them domestically. Locals also support the concept.
This is where they have victimized people. We want their trials to be held here because they committed crimes here.
We definitely support these trials. We also hope the international community can give protection until these people are put on trial.
While some trials are already underway, it remains to be seen whether the outcomes will be recognized by any international authorities or governments. For Zana Omer in Qamishli, Syria, Sirwan Kejo, VOA News.
Somali refugees are heading to the Dadaab refugee camps in Kenya to register for IDs. This in hopes of securing relocation to the U.S. and other Western countries. The rush follows the creation of a program that allows Americans to sponsor refugees arriving through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. Juma Majanga reports from the Dadaab camps.
It's a beehive of activity at the Dadaab refugee camps in northeastern Kenya as the newly arrived register for refugee IDs. Since late last year, the camps have seen more refugees from the neighboring Somalia who are escaping drought and hunger. As John Burugu, the Commissioner for Refugees Affairs in Kenya, explains.
The numbers currently are 135,000 profiled and undergoing registration in Dadaab, with an influx of about 2,000 per day. And it's high. That's a high number.
Early this year, the U.S. government launched the Welcome Corps, a private sponsorship program that allows Americans to assist refugees arriving through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program and support their resettlement and integration in the United States. At one of the temporary resettlements for newly arrived and registered refugees, Nurtu Hussein is pondering her next move. Having fled food insecurity in Somalia, the mother of seven says she hopes to resettle in the U.S. She says she wants to go to America so she can find work and provide for her children. Her children are malnourished and suffering, she says. If they go to the U.S., they will get medical support and other important services they need. She says she cannot continue keeping her children in the camp conditions because they may not survive. The Kenyan government says it is working on a plan to integrate refugees, and it welcomes help from its partners to support the refugee population. There are nearly 700,000 refugees in Kenya, according to the country's Department of Refugee Affairs. Since 2015, only 59,000 have been resettled to third countries. Unregistered refugees like Hussein and Osman and their families will have to wait for full registration before they can get consideration for resettlement. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Dadaab Refugee Camps, Kenya.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, guns are the leading cause of death for American children and teenagers. A group called Here for the Kids seeks to change that by passing a constitutional amendment to ban all guns and buy them back. But with guns so entrenched in American culture, is something like this even possible? The movement started in early June with a sit-in protest in Denver, the state capital of Colorado. I'm joined by Sayura Rao, one of the co-founders of Here for the Kids.
So guns, as you know, are the number one killer of kids and teenagers in America, and it's very simple. We set out to ban guns and buy them back by way of demanding that Governor Jared Polis sign an executive order to that effect. We didn't get that. We didn't get the executive order, but we got something extraordinary, which is the start of a movement to ban guns and buy them back.
Are you talking about banning all guns or only specific?
All guns. Banning all guns and buying them back. And what we got was the beginnings of an exquisite movement based on humanity and peace and imagination around a world where our kids don't have to, and we don't have to worry about our kids and teens going to school, the mall, the grocery store to get murdered. That's what we started on June 5th, and we're going to keep going.
I think everyone, especially those of us who have kids, applaud your goals. I'd like to talk a bit about the mechanics, though, of how something like this would work. How realistic is it in a place like the United States with so many guns already in circulation? How realistic is it to get them all back and off the streets?
Well, it's going to require imagination. How realistic was it to abolish chattel slavery, which was the entire American economy? Let's remember that. Like, look, Steve, I've talked to a ton of journalists. And I get asked this all the time. Isn't this crazy? This is impossible. Okay, well, was it crazy and impossible to abolish chattel slavery? Well, a lot of people thought, no, it wasn't crazy. And they fought and they fought and fought and they got it done. The abolitionists were considered to be insane. And, you know, it was considered impossible, irrational, crazy even, that women would have the right to vote. It was considered impossible, crazy, irrational that gay marriage would exist. So it has always taken an extraordinary imagination and people willing to put values before polls and the impossible to get anything humanity related done in this country. And guns, the number one, I say this over and over again because it's not a sideshow. This is the main event. We actually have the power. It's not cancer that's killing our kids and teens. It's guns. We can actually get rid of the things that are killing our kids and teens by just doing it. We haven't lost our minds. We have lost our imagination.
Okay, so what's next then? What do you do tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow we are in the process of planning the next action. We've taken 2 weeks. And we now have thousands, we have upwards of 5,000 people in our Mighty Network, which is where we're organizing. And we have just, the leadership team of Here for the Kids has just gotten back together after taking a 2-week break. And we're in the process of planning our second action, which will be happening this fall.
Saira Rao, founder of an organization called Here for the Kids, pushing for a constitutional amendment to ban and buy back guns. Ms. Rao, thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you, Steve. Awesome.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns in the strongest terms the ongoing human rights violations and abuses and horrific violence in Sudan, declared State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller in a statement. In particular, he noted reports of widespread sexual violence and killings based on ethnicity in West Darfur by the Rapid Support Forces and allied militias. In mid-April, tensions between the Sudanese military and its rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, erupted into open fighting in the capital, Khartoum, and elsewhere across the nation. Local groups estimate that up to 1,100 civilians have been killed in El Geneina alone, and the UN has reported more than 273,000 people are displaced in West Darfur State. The Sudan Conflict Observatory and media outlets have documented satellite imagery of sections of El Geneina and whole settlements in West, South, and North Darfur states razed to the ground by marauding forces. Credible Sudanese voices claim this is part of an emerging pattern of targeted ethnic violence against non-Arab populations. Women are bearing the brunt of this violence, and victims and human rights groups have credibly accused soldiers of the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, and allied militias of rape and other forms of conflict-related sexual violence. The atrocities occurring today in West Darfur and other areas are an ominous reminder of the horrific events that led the United States to determine in 2004 that genocide had been committed in Darfur. We specifically condemn the killing of West Darfur Governor Kamis Abakar on June 14th after he accused the RSF and other forces of perpetrating genocide, declared spokesperson Miller. We also express our concern over reports that the brother of the Sultan of the Masalit tribe and 16 others were killed in El Geneina on June 12th. While the atrocities taking place in Darfur are primarily attributable to the RSF and affiliated militia, both sides have been responsible for abuses. In Darfur, the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, has failed to protect civilians and has reportedly stoked conflict by encouraging mobilization of tribes. SAF attacks by military aircraft or drones have also impeded humanitarian efforts. Spokesperson Miller called on both sides to cease fighting in the area, control their forces, and hold accountable those responsible for violence or abuses, and enable delivery of desperately needed humanitarian assistance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.